Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor at the Bulwark, and I apologize in advance if I sound a little more nasally than usual. I've got a bit of a sinus infection, so you're just going to have to deal with it, like I am. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Netflix has had it with their employees' shit. In an update to the company's famed corporate culture memo, the streaming service emphasized that, quote, not everyone will like or agree with everything on our service. While every title is different, we approach them based on the same set of principles. We support the artistic expression of the creators we choose to work with. We program for a diversity of audiences and tastes. And we let viewers decide what's appropriate for them versus having Netflix censor specific artists or voices, end quote. The upshot of this, if you, the Netflix employee, don't agree with what you've been tasked to work on, well, too bad. Quote, if you'd find it hard to support our content breadth, Netflix may not be the best place for you, end quote. After years of companies bending over backwards to make activist voices within their organizations feel heard, I feel pretty refreshed by this candor from Netflix. The addition is clearly a response to in-house protests over Dave Chappelle's stand-up specials, which led to sparsely attended walkouts and lots of harumphing within Netflix's hallowed halls. And perhaps more importantly to the brass at Netflix, leaks. There were leaks of data, which is a thing that Netflix will not tolerate over anything else. Perhaps this is just a function of me having spent my whole life working in journals of opinions and other news organizations. But the idea that everyone has to agree with every single thing, a creator or piece of content or creator of that content or whatever, does or says is totally nuts to me. Like, I don't agree with everyone at the Bulwark, and I don't agree with every piece published at the Washington Free Beacon when I worked there. I don't agree with every one who worked at the Weekly Standard when I worked there. And just as I don't agree with every piece published at the Washington Post, where I'm a contributing columnist, right? The idea that my personal disagreement means that those people I disagree with should be deplatformed entirely is completely and utterly foreign to me. It makes no sense. But Alyssa, I am a notoriously unempathetic person. What am I missing when folks feel as though they are under personal attack because someone in their professional life has disagreed with them or done something they disagree with?
I actually probably am not the person to speak to that, shockingly, although hopefully not so shockingly to regular listeners of this podcast. I mean, I work in the Washington Post opinion section, and Fred Hyatt, my late boss, who ran the section for 20 years and hired all of us who worked there, I think at this point, you know, used to say to me and others that what our job is in an opinion section is to represent sort of the acceptable spectrum of debate. And we want to keep that spectrum pretty broad. But of course, there are things that we exclude and that Netflix would exclude, right? I mean, Netflix is not going to go into business with like the Daily Stormer. They're not going to, hire like a bunch of incels to make shows about like how women should date them instead of alphas. They're not gonna like let Vladimir Putin do a show about how like Ukraine is full of Nazis. They will let, you know, Netflix will let Saudi Arabia, you know, censor its content. But I digress a little bit. But in both cases, like, there are things that are explicitly excluded from that spectrum of acceptable opinion, but there's a lot that should remain within it. And, you know, certainly we've published stuff at the Post that I don't agree with, but I have even edited stuff for the Washington Post opinion section that I don't agree with. But the reason that we have that wide spectrum is because, you know, the more you include, the stronger statement it is when you exclude something. And if you're in the entertainment business, especially a version of the entertainment business that lives and dies by its growing number of subscriptions, you need to, again, have that be pretty wide. But in opinion writing, especially, I think there's a strong argument to be made that that encounter with the full range of opinions makes you better at articulating your sort of specific point of view because you have dealt honestly with all of the counterarguments. In the entertainment business, if you want to be big, you just have to, like, you have to be big. You have to have a lot of content that appeals to a lot of people. And, you know, I think both left, folks on both the left and right have this sense that Hollywood is on their side. And I think folks on the left in particular have advanced the argument that certain that the sort of the spectrum of opinion should be narrower, of acceptable opinion should be narrower than it actually is. And, you know, I think in Netflix's case, what the conflict over, you know, sort of Dave Chappelle's specials and his remarks on trans people were whether those remarks are should be considered part of the spectrum of acceptable opinion or whether they are, in fact, sort of Daily Stormer-like arguments that have no place in the public discourse. And, you know, Netflix, I think, and Ted Sarandos in particular, clearly believe that Dave Chappelle is an important artist and his opinions are not so far out there that they should be excluded. But I think that, yeah, when you hire people who believe that an art form is sort of broadly on their side and that specific arguments fall outside that acceptable spectrum of opinion, in order to align your workforce's understanding of what they're doing and your vision of what you're doing, you have to say pretty explicitly, you know, this is a big tent. Our job here is to curate the big tent. If that's not a job you want, that's totally fine. And I think that's a perfectly acceptable thing for a private company to say. I think it's a perfectly acceptable thing for a, you know, a journal of opinion to say. And I think it's perfectly acceptable for a, you know, a company that needs to be big to say to its employees. I don't find anything offensive about it. And I think it's actually, I think more places would benefit from having sort of upfront conversations with their employees like that. I think the transparency is useful for Netflix and for people who want to go work there.
Peter, do you think that this is a stance that is broadly applicable outside of Netflix, or is it something that other companies couldn't get away with doing? I mean, the story that keeps coming up in certainly in my Twitter feed and elsewhere. Is the idea that video game companies, for instance, really need to weigh in on Roe v. Wade. We need to get the opinion of Roe v. Wade from all of these video game companies, right? And I find that weird. I find that weird, and frankly, I don't understand why. It makes no sense to me why a employee at one of these companies would make that part of their professional life. Does my boss agree with me on abortion and its constitutionality?
I mean, I think that's actually the most important question about the new Call of Duty game. I can't think of a more important one when it comes to playing Call of Duty. Does the maker of Call of Duty, how do they feel about the leaked ruling from the Supreme Court? It just seems like it's either a good game or not based on that. That's how I feel. No, good. This whole thing is good. So look, I think I can imagine different types of companies organized different ways. And like in looked at one way, the company that makes Call of Duty, Activision, I believe it is, right? They could say the business we are in is the business of making Call of Duty and supporting abortion rights or supporting liberal causes more broadly. They could say that. That would be, like, it would be a little weird to say that's our business proposition for the world, but they could say that, and that could be the thing that they're going to do. Or they could say, we're in the business of making Call of Duty and not in the business of commenting on every or even any at all decisions that come down from the Supreme Court unless they explicitly affect the making of Call of Duty. Now, some employees might argue that that the game, like, because of the employees, right, like, might lose access to abortion rights, that, like, its relevance and that sort of thing, and executives could make that sort of decision, and these things are not always quite as cut and dried as people think. At the same time, like, typically, what companies have done is say, we're in the business of producing the service that this company produces, and we only comment on legal and political issues when they are directly relevant to the business proposition, which is to say, things like tax law, right? Like, things like, you know, is this, are there going to be subsidies for our industry? Are there going to be workplace labor regulations that will affect us directly? That sort of thing. But what seems to have happened over the last several years, particularly since the rise of Donald Trump, is that employees at a certain type of company, particularly, not always, but particularly highly educated employees at companies in the media tech world, broadly construed, want to consume political activism as basically as like a fringe benefit at their workplaces, right? As like part of their jobs, right? That's not necessarily in many cases obviously or directly related to like, are we going to sort of pursue the mission of this company? And so, you know, that is something that executives have in many cases, they've said, okay, we're going to sort of follow our employees on this. And you can understand why, because employees do have some influence at a company, right? And like, and executives are in some ways are leading and in some ways are following, their job is to kind of manage, but also follow the consensus within their companies. It's very hard to just say, we're not going to do something that all of your employees want to do.
And then sometimes you end up being Disney.
Right. But that's the other thing is like that path can be problematic. It's pretty clear to me that the Netflix statement is a business decision that is directly responding not just to the Dave Chappelle stuff, but to the Disney stuff that we have talked about on this podcast before, where the executives did not want to weigh in on Florida's what has been called the Don't Say Gay bill, the Parental Rights and Education bill. They initially were like, we're not going to comment on this. And then the employees were like, oh yeah? And they changed their mind. And it has caused a significant sort of political legislative battle to play out between Disney and the state of Florida, in which Disney has lost their sort of, it's not exactly that special, but a particular tax status for the and governance status for, or is a, has is now scheduled to lose, I guess. It's not, they haven't actually lost it yet. There's like a date when it's going to happen for where Disney World is located and all of this. And what Netflix has basically said is we're staying out of that. And you asked whether this is applicable to other companies. And I think in some ways, yes, obviously it's applicable to some of these sort of employee management disputes about whether or not to get involved in this stuff. But there is a way in which it's extremely specific to Netflix. Because if you go back a couple of years to when Netflix was really ramping up content and had not had the subscriber drop issues that they've had over the last couple of months, and when their whole thing was just spend to build, to put out as much content as possible, what they were saying was, at least implying about their strategy was, we want to be the new cable. And we want to be the new cable television by sort of appealing to everyone all the time through a niche strategy, which means that we have to produce a ton of, not just a ton of content, but a huge amount of niche content spread across the kind of ideological and interest spectrum. And if your business strategy is, we want to be able to target every single demographic and interest-based sub-niche, at least in the United States and also throughout the rest of the world, then some of that is inherently going to bother some number of people, right? Because when you target niche interests, that means that, like, it's not an interest for somebody else. And so I don't think they wanted to have that fight, because that means, like, to have that fight would mean that they couldn't pursue a sort of mega niche interests-based content strategy. Sorry, Alyssa.
Peter, if I can say just one thing about that, I think at the time that they were saying that, though some of the branding to a certain extent was, the idea was that the niches that were unfulfilled were, you know, programming by and about traditionally marginalized people. And if you look at some of their mega deals, there was a sense that they were going to pay up for people who were undervalued in the marketplace. They signed a mega deal with Kenya Barris who had created Black-ish, which was one of the first, you know, of a wave of new Black sitcoms when that genre had been, you know, sort of really kind of languished after the disappearance of UPN. They signed a big deal with Ryan Murphy. Those two deals have been, I think, like in both cases, spectacularly unsuccessful. Barris left after just having tons of disagreements with the company. Ryan Murphy has been left to just like let his insane imagination run wild without the
Ryan Murphy has made a lot of stuff, none of it watched.
Yes.
And a lot of money.
Without the,
he has made a lot of money for himself, maybe not for Netflix.
Without the restraining influence of John Landgraf, that's been kind of a disaster. Their deal with Shonda Rhimes has worked out pretty well so far, although that's like one show and one limited series in. And so I think we've yet to see if she'll create something on the scale of sort of Grey's Anatomy for sort of scope and longevity. And so I can see how some Netflix employees went there and were like, yeah, we are, you know, working for the company that's going to make, you know, more representative entertainment. And then sort of the thing that became kind of underrepresented in network television and certainly in cable television was like cheap sitcoms and very sort of mainstreamy stuff, because the cable model ate everything. And so that became a place where you could grow subscribers. And I think the other thing that's worth mentioning is that Ted Sarandos loves comedy, right? I mean, he loves stand-up comedy. And so the, you know, kind of say anything, do anything, nothing is off limits ethos is something that I think he has personally absorbed and sees it as important for Netflix to champion. And so, I mean, I don't think that employees at Netflix who are trying to narrow the scope of what can be produced and said there have the right of the argument, because like obviously that's the business strategy. I also don't think that the memo is at all sort of a bad or troublesome thing, because I think there probably was some level of misalignment between, you know, the values of the people at the top and the values of the people coming in at the bottom. And it's useful. I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing to communicate with your employees about what the values of your organization are.
I want to I want to get back to something Peter had mentioned about the idea that a certain like class of employee, techie white collar types, right, had basically accepted that their job is not just their means of, you know, creating a living, it's also the thing that gives them meaning, right? Derek Thompson wrote about this a couple years back in a great piece about what he called workism, essentially the idea that work is taking the place of the church and other community centers as the place where we find all meaning, the place where we come together and do stuff that defines who we are. And I think that's a big part of what we're seeing here, right? I think that's a huge, huge part of what the whole Netflix fight was about. And what to a certain extent the fights at Disney and at Bungie and at Activision are all about. That essentially you have a group of people who have defined themselves by their jobs, and they have defined what matters to their work, not necessarily by what matters to the company, but what matters to themselves. And that is a problem for any corporation. That is a problem for any business to be faced with. The whole point of the business is not to glorify the personal self, right? It is to create a product that you can sell to the greatest number of people.
Yeah, and one thing I would say about that is, you know, speaking as like the resident lefty on the podcast, I would strongly encourage those folks, if their politics are that important to them, to go out and work in actual politics, right? I mean, the left is in a lot of trouble in this country. And if you truly think that that is a vital and important thing, like, go work in to, like, run Democratic candidates for state house. Go out and, you know, work for the unions that are organizing Amazon and Starbucks. I think, Peter, your description of politics as sort of a fringe benefit is correct. In part because these are folks who want sort of their politics to be at the center of their work without actually having to work in politics, right? And, you know, if what you want is to work in the entertainment industry and have, like, you know, a cushy salary and get to work with celebrities, like, or whatever people do at Netflix, if you want the glamour of working at, you know, a huge content company, that's fine. But, like, don't tell yourself that it's working in politics, because it's not, right? Like, you know, take the big salary and tie 20% of that to political campaigns that you think are really important. Or, you know, go out and actually work for a campaign, work for an interest group, work for a cause. But don't pretend to yourself that making, you know, Bling Empire is doing politics, because it's not. And, you know, you can't both try and sort of sneak your politics in as a fringe benefit and say that it's the most important thing to you. You know, I care a lot about the politics that I write about and report about. I understand that there is a distinction between the work that I do and sort of on-the-ground advocacy work. I also, you know, I sort of have this cheat code in that I have a job that is, you know, where I get to advance a bunch of my values both directly and indirectly. But I also recognize the difference between what I do and activist work. And I think it would probably be useful for, you know, some employees who are approaching their jobs as the source of all meaning in their lives to say, like, if my job and my values are misaligned, is the problem that I've chosen the wrong job? And I think we would be better off, you know, we would probably be better off as a country if more people were working directly on the issues that they claim to care about instead of sort of indirectly trying to turn everything into a vehicle for issues.
So I think Sonny's point about workism and work creating meaning in people's lives is well taken. I would say not so much meaning, but it's that work has, for a lot of people, for sort of an increasingly large educated professional class, has become a source of identity. And so they want their work then to reflect the sort of the whole spectrum of their identity. And that's what a lot of these debates are. But there's also another weird thing that I just want to throw it here at the end that I think is going on, which is that there's a way in which when sort of liberals within large corporations do this, they end up, I don't know if I want to quite say proving conservatives right about corporate cultural power, but working from in some ways the same idea that a lot of critics on the right of corporate cultural power work, which is that like there's this sort of longstanding argument on the right that cultural power is effectively a kind of political power, right? That like that Disney has political power because it tells stories to our children and like sort of tells, you know, like they are in charge of delivering our national myths and like, right? Like this, I mean, you know, the fights with Disney between like Disney and the right are not new, right? This stuff has been going on at least since the 1990s when there were boycotts of Disney that ran through the, you know, through a lot of the sort of evangelical conservative political organizations. And there's a way in which when liberals say, look, well, we have a lot of cultural power that should be spent on politics, they're just kind of agreeing with the critics on the right about how cultural and political power intersect and overlap. And it's a little bit odd.
Yeah. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-troversy that Netflix told its employees to go get bent? Peter.
It's a controversy, but it's a good thing. I think Netflix's statement is productive.
Alyssa.
It's a controversy, but like Peter, I am pro-Netflix.
I think it's a non-troversy. I think any company should be able to tell its employees to shut up, get back to work. Get off the Twitter machines and go punch numbers into your computer.
Sonny just sides with management.
Should we be expecting a memo from you about our Twitter feed, Sonny?
I got a lot of complaints with you people. You're going to hear about them. All right, on this Friday's bonus episode of at atma.thebulwark.com, we're going to talk about advertisements. You know, those interruptions of your TV show to sell you stuff. One of the great things about streaming was that there were no ads for the most part. We'll take a look at how that's changing and why audiences don't care, weirdly. Get with it, audiences. God. And now, on to the main event, Moon Knight, the full season of which is now on Disney Plus, a network yet to introduce advertisements. Moon Knight stars Oscar Isaac as Stephen Grant and Mark Spector and Jake Lockley, all of them at the same time. He's Oscar Isaac as all of them because he's got split personality disorder, and they're all vying for control in an effort to do the work of Khonshu, the moon god of Egyptian lore. Turns out the Egyptian gods are real. Fun fact. And one of them, Amit, through their human avatar Arthur Harrow, who is played in this show by Ethan Hawke, hopes to, you know, do a genocide by eliminating anyone who will ever commit a sin against mankind, etc., etc. Khonshu and Grant et al. Have to stop Amit and Harrow from killing millions ahead of their scheduled time. You know, it's pretty straightforward stuff. Okay, so there are lots of nice little things about Moon Knight. And the biggest little thing, naturally, is Oscar Isaac, who gets to play around with a bunch of different accents and do a bunch of different tics in the course of bringing to life all these different characters all at the same time while still, you know, just being Oscar Isaac, right? And Ethan Hawke, it's always nice to see him. He brings a mellow edge, if that makes sense, to Harrow. Sort of disappointed slacker vibe benefiting the king of Gen X. And there's a puzzle box aspect to the show that is kind of interesting insofar as there's a suggestion that Isaac may be in a mental institution the whole time, kind of, given his own instability, but not really. Maybe that's just the afterlife or something. I don't know. It's kind of intriguing. It's entirely underbaked. It's like they took a lost subplot and jammed it in here and were like, yeah, how about that? I gotta be honest, I was mostly with the show until the finale, which is disastrous. It is a disastrous season or series finale. It's not clear if this is just going to be a 6-episode run or if there's going to be more. But this last episode was so bad. It was your kind of standard CGI-heavy, you know, Sparkle Fingers fight with the gods turned into giant versions of themselves wrestling weightlessly across the cityscape of Cairo, crashing into, you know, pyramids and stuff while the people on the ground were shooting at each other and jumping behind things and oh no, look out, there's fireworks. I have to say I went from being like pretty I was like warmly entertained, warmly positive, more or less into it, and then just like angry that I spent, you know, 4 hours of my life watching this. Even if I watched it in the least obtrusive way possible, I downloaded as many of these episodes to my phone as I could, and I watched them at the gym, because that's what this is. This is a gym show, folks. This is a piece of content. This is not art.
Did you watch them in portrait mode?
Content. No, I did not. Sadly, I did not think I had to watch them in portrait mode. Just watch them regularly. I don't know. Peter, you wanted to talk about the show, and I...
Explain yourself.
And I want answers from you, frankly. Why can't any of... answer number one. This is what I want to know first. Why can't any of these dumb Marvel things end in an interesting way?
Well, I think to get the answers you really want, you're going to have to watch season two. When it gets greenlit and when Oscar Isaac Never. Returns. And then we're going to have another conversation on this show. But you are going to have to make sure you watch the end of credits teaser scene in order to really understand all of that. And that'll set up season three, which will help you understand maybe some of the things that you... This is... Sonny, why don't you like fun? You guys always ask me why I don't like fun. This show is fun and I enjoyed it. This, like... The... I take your criticism of the final episode, which is by far the worst part of the show, and it like is exemplary of all of the things that Marvel just sort of like trudges through, right? It does dutifully that aren't great. But 5 episodes of the show are somewhere between B+ and A- as like pop culture throwaways. This is not like a show that I'm gonna go back to and watch, you know, and like think, oh man, this really deep and just like great human portrayals that like help me unlock the mysteries of like human psychology and the universe. None of that. That's not what's gonna happen. But this is an enjoyable, competent, highly competent superhero show with two very good performances, one maybe even almost great. And I was thinking about this in the context of being a superhero comic book fan as a kid. And from about the age of 6 or 7 through about the age of 14, so this is late 1980s through sometime in the mid-1990s, I was a pretty regular comic book reader. And there were all these rumors at the time that like every property was going to get turned into a movie, right? And like mostly we just got Batman movies, right? There weren't a whole lot of comic book movies being made at the time, but everything was going to be turned into a movie. Everything was going to be a TV show, and so I was always sort of imagining these things, and they never actually arrived. And if a show like this had been around when I was 11, I would have loved it. Just like absolutely flipped for this. There are so many fun ideas. Like it's just dark enough to feel a little bit edgy if you're, you know, if you're like a kid who's not quite an adolescent or just like verging into adolescence. If you are a comic book fan who has read a bunch of them, one of the things this show does is, like Loki last year, it channels some of the zany,
sort of not quite cosmic, but almost like historical, spiritual weirdness of the comic books, which, like, yeah, we've got, like, there's new gods and there's all these sort of godlike creations who, like, sort of intersect with your space aliens and also with your caped heroes and all that stuff. Like, comic books, just by virtue of being, of there being so many of them and having so many stories over so many years, get kind of fun and weird. And Moon Knight approaches that more than some of the other stuff, you know, some of the other Marvel series. And I think that I really think the first five episodes are just nearly not quite perfect, but like they're
not even close.
They're, so they're not
perfect.
They're not quite
not quite perfect. Give me a break.
They go down so easy.
Not quite perfect.
They go down so easy. There was no point at which I was like, oh, I really want something radically different. This seems like a big mistake or a big flaw. I just sort of felt like, ah, this is silly. This is designed to amuse me. And I, you know, and again, just to like draw a comparison, there's a lot of comic book superhero stuff being produced in Hollywood right now, and this is in, I would say, the top third of it. Maybe not the top 10%, but the top third. You like think about something like Morbius, which Sonny, you and I watched recently, and just how turgid and terrible it is, even with a big star in the center, in the lead role, even with a whole bunch of money, a director who has made some very competent stuff in the past. That movie was just, like, I won't say it was unwatchably bad because I did sit through watching all of it, but it was just awful in every single way, lazy and miserable and miserly in terms of its ideas. And now you get something like Moon Knight, which is just determined in every single scene to deliver amusement, fun, like pleasure to its audience. And then at the end, you get like a very typical Marvel sort of overstuffed CG battle, because every Marvel show has to end with a big battle, and that's how they look. And I think that's like, that's the only thing you can say about that final episode, is that Marvel has decided that you have to have that big fight to resolve things, and we're going to get that big fight every single time now. And like, you can just, like, you can get up and leave if you need to. You're at the gym, so maybe you can't. But if you watch it at home, you can just get up and make yourself a drink and be like, ah, there's the crocodile fighting the CG other monster. This looks fun. It's fun.
Why do you not like fun, Sonny? It was a giant walking CGI crocodile. I mean, look, the other episodes in this series were fine in the sense that it's like fun to watch Oscar Isaac do his acting thing. I enjoy that, and I like Ethan Hawke.
And the action scenes are highly competent, nicely done.
The action scenes are very okay. I mean, the action scenes even before the last episode were at best okay, and at worst, like, kind of, again, weightless. And like the fight through the museum where he's fighting an invisible jackal, or invisible to everybody else, he can see it, but
there's
like,
all
that
cool
looked,
lighting
it just
like
cheap.
I mean, I think a lot of that stuff works very well. It works better than a lot of movies, honestly.
I don't know,
but I want to hear what Alyssa thought.
It doesn't work that well. Alyssa, what did you make of this dumb show?
I feel like this show went, like, just purely went in my eyes and out through the back of my head and left basically no impression. It did something. I will say it achieved something that I thought was not achievable, which is, it's a show with an Oscar Isaac performance that made me wish I was watching a show with a Dan Stevens performance, which is Legion. And I don't know if the two of you watched that, but it was FX's like crazy superhero show with Dan Stevens playing an asylum inmate who discovers that he's actually a superhero. And it's full of just like real weird, fun performances. It's got Rachel Keller, who was seen most recently as Samantha in Tokyo Vice. It's got Aubrey Plaza in a just like really unsettling and enjoyable performance. Bill Irwin is in it, and he's great. You've got Gene Smart. But that was a show, that's a superhero show that, you know, had the same, like, this protagonist is unwell concept. It looked awesome. It was just super weird and compelling. And, you know, I guess I get why you like this, Peter, but as the one of the three of us who is just burned out most by the sort of sameness of the Marvel formula, you know, I love Oscar Isaac. I'm a real Oscar Isaac completist. I think he's incredible. This just, it's just more of the same. I mean, it's like, it's different by the like 5% that each new Marvel property is allowed to be different, but that's just not different enough for me at this stage to be particularly interesting. I will say the one thing that I find kind of fascinating about this and Doctor Strange is like the straight up, like the soul exists element of the Marvel universe, which I think is sort of under-discussed. But it's like, I think it's interesting for a franchise that is as much like, you know, sort of atheist and, you know, superheroes and tech billionaires are our new gods. It's like, yeah, there's the soul. It can get get fucked up if you do weird magic, as in Doctor Strange. Like, it can travel to one of many underworlds. Like, I just...
Well, that's... So I want to hit on that just for a second, because this is actually, like, the most interesting idea in the show. And the show does nothing with it because it's not interested in ideas. This is not a show of ideas. But the most interesting idea in the show is that essentially both of the main... alternate personas, the main, you know, dissociative identities, have souls of their own.
Yep.
And when one of them is lost, the other has to go back and kind of find it. And there's also a tossed-off line that the Hippo Goddess, we haven't even talked about the Hippo Goddess, makes about the ancestral plane, which is a reference to the afterlife that we see in Black Panther, where the Wakandans go, which creates this kind of idea of, like, everybody has their own different personal afterlife that everybody goes to, and it just kind of depends on where you come from or what faith tradition you believe
very,
in.
Very, like, pre-Christian, pantheistic in its treatment of this stuff, but that is in many ways traditional to the comic books, which have always just sort of smashed up Star Wars-y alien stuff with very conventional tights superhero stuff with all sorts of crazy religious kind of sometimes
all religions,
you know,
are true.
Yeah, sometimes, except when they're not, right? Like, except when it turns out to be that it's like Hobgoblin is actually just an effects guy wearing some makeup, right? Like they just play with all of these concepts in ways that are very freeform, and Moon Knight doesn't totally get there because it's just focused on the one character, but it gestures at a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been interesting to, you know, think about and wrestle with some.
Well, and what's the difference? I mean, I think there's something interesting to be done. Like, what's the difference between a god and a superpower and a superhero, right? And, you know, like, is there sort of a higher morality or, you know, higher force at work that even superheroes are subject to?
Did the gods get half wiped out by Thanos?
The gods versus superpowers, you know, superheroes thing has, you know, is obviously that idea has been raised before. And I think there's like a way in which it's right, which is that the gods, you know, the Greek gods in particular, they were understood to be gods, but they were also these larger than life figures who could deliver sort of cultural, moral understandings through stories, right? And people understood how to live and what being a person was about by hearing the stories of the Greek gods. And those myths became like sort of got passed out and right and passed around and retold. And this is a thing we do with comic books, is that every one of these heroes has had their origin story, you know, told 10 dozen different times. I mean, if not always on screen, certainly on the pages, right? Is that these characters are simple archetypes sometimes that can be then, you know, a bunch of details filled in to be made more complex. They're simple archetypes that can like give us, that can both entertain us and like reveal a little bit about our world and our lives.
Well, and more than that, Peter, I mean, the Greek gods are understood to be actively interventionist in human affairs, right? Yeah. And so, you know, in the Trojan War, like a lot of what you have in the Trojan War is various gods and goddesses like deciding to mess around in human events in the way that sort of contemporary superheroes do now. And, you know, I mean, I think that mainstream Protestantism, Catholicism to a certain extent, Reform and Reconstructionist Judaism, for example, have really moved away from that idea, right? I mean, there are a lot of Jews who believe that God sort of set the world in motion, but what happens next is up to us. But, you know, you do have evangelical and charismatic Protestant traditions that I think in a lot of cases, hew to a view of God that is much more sort of specifically interventionist, in the same way that the Greeks would have understood the gods messing in human affairs, although like a little bit more contractual and transactional. And so it's just interesting to think a little bit about the distinction between gods and superheroes and whether it exists, in part because that would be a place where Marvel actually has, you know, more resonance to the way we live in the world now. But that will never really happen because that's not what Marvel's in the business of doing.
That would be much more interesting than anything they were trying to do in Moon Knight. So what do we think about Moon Knight? Thumbs up or thumbs down, Peter?
Thumbs up. It's good.
Alyssa.
It's perfectly acceptable background. Thumbs, like there's chaos in it, to quote Arthur Harrow.
Your scales are balanced. My scales are thumbs down. Send this to the afterlife.
Oh, wow.
Where it'll turn into sand.
Huge disagreement.
Or whatever.
Here.
Guys, you should just thank me for not making you do an episode on Hawkeye.
Should we?
I specifically shot down an episode on Hawkeye. You were demanding to do Hawkeye. I was like, no, we've done enough Marvel crap. And it's going to, you know, God, I guess we'll have to do one when Thor Love and Thunder comes out. But we're not doing any more of these TV shows. I'll
people
tell you
love
much.
Marvel,
right,
man.
That's it for this.
And yeah, I am people.
I'll make us do a She-Hulk episode and then we can be done.
They don't love it enough to do back-to-back MCU weeks, I tell you what. All right, that's it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com on advertisements and why people love them. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch, and I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.